Join the conversation online. Facebook.com/ABC Speaking Out.
Look, listen, and learn knowledge.
Aunty Millie Ingram was born and raised in Wiradjuri country, but she moved to Redfern and has been a leading figure in the community for decades. Aunty Millie, thank you for being with us this evening.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Larissa.
Now, I was wondering if you could tell us about where you grew up.
I grew up on the Erambi Aboriginal Reserve in Cowra, and I left there when I was 15 when I first came to Sydney to work, and that was in Redfern, and it was at the Sydney University where, at the time, it wasn't Sydney University, it was what they called at that time the Deaf and Dumb School, which now wouldn't be allowed.
No, you couldn't say that.
But they called it that at the time. Yeah. So I worked there, got homesick, went back home for a couple of years and then come back when I was 18 and stayed on.
What drew you as a young Aboriginal woman back to Sydney?
Work. I'd always had a good work ethic, and trying to get work in the country was just impossible, so we came down here to Sydney to get work.
And what was it like in Redfern in those days?
It was good, and it was similar to what most of the Aboriginal people that came, because there's lots of factories, there's all different sorts of chocolate factories, handbag factories, shoe factories, and even there was a Mallee's electrical thing down at Alexandria, so people could get jobs fairly easily back in those days. The pay was poor, but there were plenty of jobs. And of course, the relatives that already lived in Redfern, we would go and stay with relatives until you got enough money to get your own place.
And there was, obviously, you arrived here, it started to become, you know, one of the really dynamic places of Indigenous politics in the country. Mm. Tell us a bit about what it was like being here during that time.
Oh, it was amazing. I think we were all working in the factories and we were all really, it was really good friendship with La Perouse as well, because a lot of the La Perouse women came and worked in a lot of the factories in here. So there was that good camaraderie between La Perouse and Redfern. And on the weekends we would play football. And of course you'd turn up and everybody knew each other there. And that was always really good back in those days in the late 50s and early 60s. And so I've still got some friends out of La Perouse. We're all getting pretty old now, but we're still here. We still have those memories, and their children remember us too because of parents talking. And that was great, and I think that will remain, and it still remains between the football relationship between La Perouse and Redfern.
And tell us a little bit about how you started to then really get involved with the Indigenous community organisations. Where did the fire in your belly come from around being really proactive on Indigenous issues in the community?
I think we can mostly pinpoint that to Charlie Perkins coming here and setting up the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And I had had some problems in the factory. I was a really good worker. And when I got sacked for something that was so trivial, it was just ridiculous. And I never thought about it being racism. I just thought that the poor lady did the wrong thing, so I called the union in. And I won that fight against that person and that company of getting my job back. So that was about 1960. And so that was a good little win for me, and sort of, I think that's what put the fire in the belly. But that goes back further, because my father was a shearer and he was always fighting for his rights as a shearer, as I think most Aboriginal men did back in those days. And he always told us when we started to work to make sure you join the union.
Well, you know, we often look at the political figures within the Aboriginal rights movement over the decades, and often they seem to be male. But of course, even just within your family of Ingram sisters, there's been a lot of activity involved in the Indigenous community. But it seems like the work women do within the community is much more behind the scenes and community focused. Do you think there's a different style of Indigenous women's leadership?
Oh, absolutely. We've always said that we can't fight against our men, because that would be another division that we can't afford. There's too few of us. But we don't accept anything that the men do, if it's domestic violence or anything like that. But the women were, you're quite right, they were the silent achievers. And my mum fought against the mission manager all the time, because if the mission manager, if he had a bad day, he would keep the rations back. And we would go hungry for days on end until he saw fit to give us the slip to get our rations so we could have something to eat. And my mum rounded up all the women on the mish, took them down to the police station and asked the police to move the mission manager to give the ration slips out so we could eat. And she said, I'm not going home to my children starving again. And so the police sergeant at the Cowra police station had rang the welfare board and said, you'd want to do something about this mission manager up here because he's starving these women and children. So my mum initiated it. The police officer was really good because he knew mum. She knew mum to be a good person. And the mission manager complained that he lost his job over her.
Well, you guys have been making trouble for decades.
Still doing it.
Yes, well, you are. But, I mean, you must look back at Redfern, how it was when you arrived there and where it is now. And, you know, obviously you've been one of the key elders who've been facilitating the changes that have happened there. But when you look back over that period, where do you see the most positive changes as having come from?
The positive changes are the growth of the people. I think all of those people, Charlie Perkins started up the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And he used to have all these gatherings down there, whether they were dances, sing-alongs or concerts, and just even giving out some welfare support and helping them to get homes and things like that. Nearly all of our leaders of today and those leaders in the 60s went to Charlie Perkins' Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, and that's, I think, where they honed their knowledge about their rights and their human rights in this country. And I admire all those people. We know all the young fellows that were there, and even Gary Foley says the same thing. You know, that's where he grew up, him and Gary Foley, Gary Williams, Billy Craigie and Michael Anderson, all of them. Redfern was where they started to kickstart it all. But I think it's because of Charlie coming and telling them that they had their rights and they had their human rights in this country.
The other thing that is a real legacy from Redfern from the 60s and 70s is not just the political ideas that were really developed there, but it was also the home of community-controlled Indigenous organisations with the medical service and the legal service. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what you see the role of Indigenous community-controlled services as being. Why are they so important to an Aboriginal community?
They're so important because they belong to the Aboriginal people. They have ownership over it, and it gives them a little bit of power over their own lives. Now, my belief is that it started from the Tent Embassy, and that's why we'll always absolutely support the Tent Embassy in Canberra, because after the referendum, we expected all these wonderful things to happen. And I think that a lot of the people who started off the medical service, people like Fred Hollows and others and that probably said, well, we've got the referendum now, what are we going to do? But the government didn't do anything. The government didn't, and the government's still not doing anything, right? But the people, our fellow Australians, started to say, well, we've got to do something. And they helped to start the medical service off. And with Mum Shirl and Bob, Dr. Sykes and Naomi Mayers and all of them, really good people. But like the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs started off with support from non-Aboriginal Australians, but they handed it over to Aboriginal control when it was the right time. And that was good, and that happened with the legal service, the medical service and the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And they've happened ever since, because what happened is that Aboriginal people weren't getting the health care they needed because of severe racism, and Aboriginal people were going to jail far too often, and so they're without legal support. And I think what we have to do today is still ask, why are so many Aboriginal people in custody? My belief on that is that it's an industry. It's an industry that if you want to have jails and you want to privatise them and you want somebody else to run them, you got to have the fodder. And they won't cut down on their entitlements, funding entitlements. They will continue to arrest Aboriginal people for mediocre stuff without giving those people their rights. It's a disgrace on this country. It's an indictment on this country, and I think we should broadcast this internationally as much as possible how they're violating the human rights of our young people here in this country, and all because of their industry, want to keep their people in jobs. They can reinvest that. If they reinvested that into cultural camps with educational programs, cultural programs, so they can go out and understand the land and their own culture, combined with educational programs so they can fit into the white world if they want to, those educational camps would be beneficial for government as well, because they won't be having to pay billions of dollars out for prisons and the support staff in the prisons to keep them there. That is primarily there to incarcerate Aboriginal people.
Now, you've also been involved very heavily with the Wyanga Aboriginal Aged Care Program. Yes. What issues are there facing older Aboriginal people?
Their main thing is that they want security and tenure in their home, their accommodation that they have, and safety. That's the two main things. They don't want to be close to family. They don't want to be sent out to places where they're not in community. They've got to be here. And Redfern is our multicultural community with all our different nations gathering in Redfern. So we're sort of our little Aboriginal multicultural society here, and they want to stay because you can always walk up in Redfern and see an Aboriginal person. My worry is it's had to become so gentrified. And it's gentrified because people are moving in there. First off, you move in because the properties are cheap, and then they want to increase their property value. So they start picking on the Aboriginal people. Move the Aboriginal people out and their property values will go up. That's what worries me. And I'm worried that if all low-income people, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, are moved out of there, it'll just become another Paddington, another Woollahra, another Balmain and all those sorts of places. And you can see that's happening.
You've also been really heavily involved in the land rights system through the Land Council. Why are land rights still so important to Aboriginal people?
I think it's fundamental to all of us. That's what we are. We belong to this land. And we belong to the land and we're the custodians of the land. And we were the original custodians. And at times I say all Australians have to start thinking of them being custodians of the land. They've got to help us to look after this land. I was quite concerned when I heard about the fracking. You know, I've been fighting with the people against fracking and mining and that. And they say they're doing it for the economy. I think they're not. I don't believe that. But the government has their stories about they need the money. So I think it was in Oklahoma that they have earthquakes for the first time and they say it's from the fracking. And so that message is coming out of America about fracking. And are we still giving licences out here for fracking? And as a matter of fact, fracking and mining is against all Aboriginal people's feelings because they're destroying the land. And the land, we belong to the land. And I think all of us as human beings belong to the land and the land of our country.
You've also obviously kept very involved with debates around a treaty and constitutional reform. From your perspective, just personally as an Aboriginal woman and an elder in our community, what's your view on recognition in the constitution and how that might fit in with a treaty?
I don't have a problem with the recognition, but they better get on with it. Because I am totally opposed to $180 million in 5 years being wasted and they haven't even come up with a question yet. So where is the justice? Now, we could have done a lot with that $180 million to be put over. I've said to the expert panel and others that we thought there was going to be great changes in the changes amendment to the Constitution in 1967. And we didn't think anything dynamic about that. Nothing happened till the tent embassy went up and started to shame the government. But they didn't do it of their own free will. And I'm thinking the same thing's going to happen with this proposed amendment. Now, what I would like to see personally is that they have some sort of preamble in the beginning and that backed up with something in the content in the body of the Constitution, something meaningful. And don't get put off by all the shock jocks and everybody out there that's blasting it. And when you get both John Howard and Tony Abbott coming out and saying, no way in the world will we have a treaty. I support the idea of a treaty, and that can either go one big treaty across the whole nation, but I think most people want individual treaties with all different nations. Either way, I don't mind, but that's up to the people to decide that. And I think that one of the things I thought that maybe we should have a Bill of Rights so that individual people can have their rights as an individual, not go in there collectively as a whole group, like the government loves to lump us in there with them collectively, all you Aboriginal people, you people, that terrible, terrible thing that they say, you people. But maybe a Bill of Rights as well. But I support the amendment to the Constitution if they get on with it. And they now want to prolong it for a little while, God knows how long. And that's money, as far as I'm concerned, wasted, particularly when they're cutting back on organisations right across this country, particularly when we've got one third of our babies and our children in out-of-home care and so many people incarcerated and the highest suicide rate per capita in the entire world. Isn't this government ashamed? Why don't they do something about that? Now, compared with that and compared with the amendment to the Constitution, I'll take reinvestment in our community so Aboriginal people can deal with the day-to-day issues as well.
Well, one of the things I love most about hosting Speaking Out is I get to talk to some of my favourite people. And Aunty Millie, you are my favourite auntie.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming by Speaking Out this evening and having a chat with us.